longer had the power to send anyone to their room. They could stand up and leave whenever they liked. They could move interstate or overseas. They could choose to never visit, to never call, to never have children. The children had all the power now. And how inappropriate to behave like this in front of Savannah. Stan's fist on the table might remind her of previous foster placements with abusive fathers. No one knew what that child might have suffered. Stan leaned forward on the table, his shoulders huge and muscled in the shirt that Amy had given him, a size too small. This one was a beautiful player. Stan pointed at Amy, his eyes on Savannah. Impeccable ground strokes. The ball just fizzed off her racket. It was a pleasure to watch her play. Oh, it was true. It had been a pleasure to watch Amy play. Joy and Stan used to exchange smiles as their ponytailed daughter glided back and forth across the court when she was maybe 8 or 9, back when she had a funny little personality, not a possible mental illness. Joy never forgave the GP who wrote that particular referral letter. We used to call her the comeback queen, reflected Stan. Remember? He looked down the table at Joy. I do remember, said Joy carefully, because that was much later, and that wasn't such a good memory. She'd suspected that as Amy got older, she began to deliberately lose points or games just so she could claw her way back to a win. Amy loved being the underdog. It was a dangerous, stupid strategy against the better players. The better players gripped that lead between their teeth and ran with it. Amy had lost matches she should have won because she'd mounted her comeback too late. Once, she lost 9 games in a row and still went on to win the match, reflected Stan. Incredible. But, said Amy airily, does anyone need another tea or coffee? Asked Joy. But then she got to 14 or 15 and she started choking, said Stan. Simple as that. It had been awful to witness. Amy would shout at herself. It wasn't her opponent she was fighting, but herself, the voice in her head. Amy, you stupid idiot! Sometimes Joy felt like that summed up Amy's whole life, a constant power struggle with a cruel, invisible foe. Choking? Asked Savannah. Amy wrapped both hands around her throat, stuck her tongue out, and put her head on one side. It's a sports term, Stan explained to Savannah. It basically means that your state of mind prevents you from reaching your potential. Stan, said Joy. It felt like he was undressing in public, or undressing his family. It felt deeply personal. These were conversations they'd had about their children in the privacy of their bedroom. Amy did choke. If she was serving for the match, you could almost guarantee she'd double fault. Joy, said Stan. He couldn't be stopped. It was like standing in front of a semi-trailer speeding towards you. He said, Amy lost the match in her own mind before she'd even walked out on that court, and her mother and I, we just couldn't work out how to fix me, finished Amy. No, said Stan, not fix you, help you. Move it along, Dad, said Amy. She bundled her hair up into a messy top knot, put her elbows on the table and locked her hands together. Joy knew it was only a defense mechanism, but Amy's mocking, glamorous smile reminded Joy of Stan's mother. Joy hated it when Stan's bloody mother made a guest appearance on her beloved children's faces. Let's hear why the others failed. No one failed. Joy's stomach cramped. And I'm sure Savannah isn't interested in this. Oh, no, it's very interesting, said Savannah brightly, as if she couldn't sense the tension in the room. It was the first time Joy had ever felt even slightly annoyed with her. Stan jerked his head at Logan. This one was an athlete. Jesus, he was an athlete. Doesn't look like it now, of course. Gee, thanks, Dad. Logan lifted his wine glass in a mocking toast. He had one of the most powerful forehands I've ever seen. Extraordinary. Powerful, yes, but would we call it accurate? Asked Troy with a sidelong look at his older brother, and Logan gave him the rude finger as if they were both little boys. Logan was so fit. Stan ignored Troy. He was into his stride now. It had been years since he'd had the chance to talk to someone with no previous knowledge and such apparent interest in the topic of his children's tennis. He could play for hours and look like he'd just walked onto the court. I remember one match when Logan was up against this kid who was meant to be the next big thing. Stan's eyes shone with the memory of that long-ago January day. Logan wore that kid out. Every game was deuce, add, deuce, add, deuce, add. Every rally was a marathon. We're talking 10, 15-shot rallies. 1 hour in, that was it. This other kid, this supposed star, he was done. Stan sliced his palms sideways. Meanwhile, this one, he pointed his thumb at Logan, fresh as a daisy, barely broke a sweat. Joy hadn't been at that match, but she must have heard the story 100 times, and each time Stan told it with such delight, his head unconsciously going back and forth like a tennis spectator as he chanted, deuce, add, deuce, add. But, Logan took another 2 brownies, one from each plate. My turn for the but. Logan never truly committed to the sport. He just didn't want it enough. He never had that burning desire. It was like he could take it or leave it. He was too passive, said Logan, with a strange expression on his face. Is that the word you were looking for, Dad? I was going to say, you are just too nice, said Stan. I sometimes wondered if you even liked winning. You hated seeing the other kid lose. I liked winning, muttered Logan. He aggressively massaged the back of his neck. Bloody hell, Dad. How much of my childhood did I spend on the court if I didn't commit to the sport? How much more committed did I need to be? Yeah, but mate, like I said, you just didn't have that desire. Stan discarded poor Logan and turned his gaze to Troy. Now, Troy had the desire because all he cared about was beating you and Amy. Younger siblings always end up the better players. Look at Venus and Serena. But see, the thing with Troy, Stan shook his head and clicked his tongue. Troy was a show pony. Still is, said Logan. Troy whinnied. Brooke giggled. Savannah smiled uncertainly. He was all about the showreel, said Stan. He'd go for shots that Federer wouldn't go for. Show-off shots. And sometimes he'd get those shots, but I'd say to him, spectacular doesn't win the match, filled in Troy. He picked up his glass. Could someone pass me the wine? Exactly. Stan twitched as the Father's Day balloon brushed against his face. Spectacular doesn't win the match. You have to have substance. He pushed the balloon gently away as if it were a small child trying to look over his shoulder. If Joy and Stan were having this conversation alone, she would have told him it was nothing to do with bloody substance. It was focus. Troy could keep his concentration for only so long, and then it was gone. That was the kid's fatal flaw. He'd be a set and a half up, and Joy would see him staring dreamily at the sky or checking out some attractive young girl in the stands. He did the show-off shots to keep himself interested. Behold, a man without substance. Troy made jazz hands. And then there was the altercation with Harry, said Stan. Shut up, thought Joy. Shut up, shut up, shut up, you stupid man. Isn't it my turn yet? Asked Brooke quickly. You never really came back from that, said Stan to Troy. I did get a tennis scholarship to Stanford, Troy told Savannah, but that meant nothing to my parents. It certainly did not mean nothing, said Joy. It meant you went to the other side of the world and returned an entirely different person. After America, it was like he'd been shellacked. You could tap your fingertip against that shiny, hard, cheerful surface. Troy couldn't control his temper, said Stan. Inherited his hot temper from his mother. He chuckled, as if he could turn one of the most distressing events of their family history into a funny anecdote suitable for sharing with new friends. He was a racket thrower. We had to tie his racket to his wrist. Not we, said Joy, you. I thought it would ruin his grip. But it didn't, did it? Said Stan. His grip wasn't the problem. I know it's your day, Dad, said Amy, but could we change the subject? Don't worry about it, Amy, said Troy, as Brooke silently passed him the wine. I don't care. Anyhow, I thought we had the temper under control. He was 13 when it happened, said Stan to Savannah. He got banned for 6 months. Fair enough, too. He was 14, thought Joy. He'd turned 14 the day before. Playing against a Delaney student, Harry Haddad. Stan paused, allowing space for Savannah to give a little gasp of recognition, but Savannah just looked blankly back at him. Famous Australian player. Former number one. Won Wimbledon twice. Won the US Open a few years back. It was beyond Stan's comprehension that she wouldn't recognise the name. Oh, yes, of course, I've heard of him, said Savannah, clearly pretending. Joy thought how refreshing it was to have someone in the house with so little interest in tennis she hadn't even heard of Harry Haddad. He was a former student of mine, said Stan. He glanced at Joy, corrected himself. Former student of ours. He's been in the news because he's in training now to make a comeback. Anyhow, so back to the story. Troy was playing against him and not doing so well. Dad, said Amy, please, let's not talk about Harry Haddad. It's not good for my mental health. I feel like it's not good for your mental health. Another thing to mention is that Harry Haddad was a snivelling little cheat. Troy studied his wine glass. Never saw it happen, said Stan, calmly, but with that edge, the edge still sharp enough to make his children bleed. He still didn't get it. Even after all these years, he never saw how he betrayed Troy every time he made that statement. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, said Troy evenly. How can you cheat? Asked Savannah. Isn't there, like, a ref? There are no chair umpires at the lower levels, said Brooke. The players make their own line calls. It's hard for some kids to be ethical. It's hard for some grown-ups, said Joy. She'd seen plenty of players at the club make questionable line calls. Sometimes umpires can be biased too. She thought of the first time she played in the under-13s grass court championships at White City. Her grandfather was busy that day, and so her mother took her. Her mother, bored out of her mind, flipped through Vogue while Joy played. Joy couldn't understand why the umpire kept calling her shots out and her opponent's shots in. She later discovered the umpire was her opponent's mother. Well, you're much prettier than her, her mother said on the way home, as if that was what counted. It did help a little bit. Look at his talent, Troy. Look at where he got. He didn't need to cheat. Stan was still stuck on the topic of Harry. He would forever be stuck on the topic of Harry. He grabbed the string of the balloon and snapped it free from the chair so that it floated up to the ceiling. Oh, said Amy sadly, watching it go. Good to see you're still so loyal to him, Dad, said Troy, considering how loyal he was to you. Brooke sucked in air through her teeth, as if she'd stubbed her toe. Stan pulled at the fabric of his too tight shirt with such ferocity, Joy was reminded of the Incredible Hulk bursting free of his ordinary clothes when he lost his temper. Troy used to adore that show, perhaps because of his own unstoppable temper. It was Harry's father's decision to drop me. Stan spoke calmly. He wasn't going to explode into the Hulk. To drop us. He directed his attention to Savannah. Harry's father decided to change coaches. He shrugged. A big fake shrug. It happens. Tennis parents are a unique breed. They get some success and they start looking for something bigger and better. That's life in the coaching game. Maybe it wasn't a fake shrug. His insouciance seemed almost believable. Did he truly feel that now? Was he over it? But I guess you must still feel really proud that you discovered him, said Savannah. We do feel proud, said Stan. Sure. He looked uncertainly around the table. Where was I? His eyes caught on Brooke and his face softened. The little one. The little one who is a whole inch taller than me, commented Amy, her gaze still on the balloon. Brooke was the smartest of our kids, said Stan. Thanks, Dad. Troy tipped his finger to his forehead. On the court, said Stan. She was the smartest and most strategic one on the court. She had to be, because she was playing you lot, and you were all so much bigger and faster than her. She was analysing her competitors' weaknesses at an age when most kids were just thinking about getting the ball over the net. It was true that Brooke was clever on the court, but Joy had never really enjoyed watching her play as much as the others, because Brooke herself seemed to take no pleasure in the game. That permanent frown made its first appearance when Brooke was about 8, even before the headaches. But Brooke gets migraines, said Stan. It was a terrible, terrible shame. He shook his head with such regret and sadness, you would think he was describing Brooke's early death, not her early retirement. Joy remembered the day Stan and Brooke came home hours early from a tournament. What are you doing here? Joy had asked. She was rushing out the door on her way to fill in for one of the coaches who had called in sick. She was in a permanent rush in those days. She's done, said Stan. She's finished. What happened? Joy asked as Brooke walked past her and went straight to her room without saying a word. But the look she shot at Joy seemed so accusatory. And when she looked at Stan, she saw the same accusation in his eyes. You failed. Because the children's medical care was her responsibility, and she couldn't fix Brooke's headaches. That doctor you take her to has no fucking clue, Stan had said. And what Joy should have done was tell Stan to take her class for her, and she should have gone and comforted Brooke. But she was so angry with Stan for swearing at her, for blaming her, that she didn't even think of it. She just left, slamming the door behind her. If we'd got the right medical advice, things might have been different, said Stan now. And Joy felt that long-ago frustration rise within her, as if it were yesterday. Savannah lifted up Amy's plate of brownies. Would anyone... I took her to doctor after doctor after doctor, said Joy. No one is blaming you, Mum, said Brooke, as the dog began to whine. Well, it certainly sounds... Indira left me, said Logan, and the room fell instantly silent. Chapter 24. Logan sat upright and stoic after his announcement, his forearms on his armrests as if he were strapped to the electric chair. Even the dog seemed shocked and gazed steadfastly at the wall as if to point out this awful business was nothing to do with her. Eh? What's that? Said Stan confusedly. Now just seemed like as good a time as any to mention it, said Logan. Oh, Logan! Amy looked back down from the balloon. We love her! When Logan had arrived today and said that Indira was at home sick, Joy had a thought, a deliriously hopeful thought. Maybe she's feeling sick because she's pregnant. That cryptic look on Indira's face the last time Joy saw her had not been the indication of a special secret announcement she was waiting for the safe 12-week mark to make. She'd been getting ready to leave. The flower magnet Joy had so hoped was an ultrasound picture had been a farewell gift. I loved her too, said Logan. Did she know that? Asked Amy. Should have put a ring on it. Troy shook his head in mock exasperation. Says you, said Logan. I've been married. You haven't stayed married. Brooke opened her mouth as if to say something and then briefly closed her eyes. Have you got a migraine coming on, Brooke? Asked Joy. A cramping sensation hit her lower abdomen again. She suppressed a groan. You mustn't drive home if you do. You must never drive when you're suffering a migraine. I'll drive her home, offered Savannah. I don't have a migraine, snapped Brooke. We've talked enough about migraines today. Joy didn't believe her. She really didn't look well. If you do, maybe you should stay here. Grant won't be much use to you if he's sick. Grant and I have broken up too. Brooke spoke so rapidly, it took Joy a moment to separate out the words. I beg your pardon? Brooke exhaled and her shoulders sagged. It's a relief to say it. She looked at her father. Sorry to ruin Father's Day. She looked at Logan, although Logan started it. It's all right, sweetheart, said Stan with deep sadness. He patted Brooke on the shoulder before slumping back in his chair. These things happen. Joy said, you mean you're getting a divorce? It's just a trial separation for now, but Brooke squinted as if at a sudden bright light. It looks that way. Joy should have realized this was more than a migraine. The poor girl looked exhausted, pale and haggard, with dark circles under her eyes, and her hair was just so lank. Troy put his arm around his sister. How long? He asked. We've been separated for 6 weeks.
6 weeks?
Joy didn't mean it to sound like an admonishment, but how could Brooke have been separated for 6 weeks without saying a single word about it to her parents?
Was it all the pressure you put on yourself with that damned clinic?
Now she was accidentally giving away her hatred of the clinic. She was getting this all wrong. This was becoming one of those pivotal life moments she would wish she could go back and do again so she could say all the right things. She put her fingertips to her hairline. She was sweating. Food poisoning? Savannah's roast chicken had been so wonderfully tender. Was this the price you had to pay for tender chicken? It was too high a price.
I should have helped out more at the clinic, she said to Brooke. She should have. Grant probably felt neglected. I should have insisted.
Oh, Mum, said Brooke wearily.
I can't believe you never told me, said Amy.
Can we not make it about you, Amy? Said Brooke. Amy's face crumpled.
I just meant I could have helped you.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm fine. Brooke massaged tiny circles in her forehead with her fingertips. I'm sorry. I just wasn't ready to talk about it. I thought we might work it out. Nobody needs to get upset.
Savannah had folded her napkin into a neat square, concealing her mostly uneaten brownies. What must she think of them all?
It was embarrassing to remember how she'd worried that Savannah would be envious of Joy's loving, stable family.
Well, Joy said to Savannah, I hope this isn't too awkward for you. All these upsetting announcements on Father's Day.
Sorry, Dad, said Logan remorsefully. I didn't mean to ruin Father's Day.
Neither did I, said Brooke. Sorry, Dad.
No one needs to be sorry, said Stan.
He looked at the balloon floating above his head, grabbed for the end of the string and pulled it down. He clutched the balloon like a child in a stroller being pushed around a fairground.
What are you doing? Joy asked him.
Holding my balloon, said Stan.
Do you actually need me to give you all some privacy? Asked Savannah. I could go to my room.
She corrected herself in a sudden fluster and glanced at Amy. Not my room.
We don't need privacy, said Stan. We're fine. These things happen. It's no one's fault.
Of course it's no one's fault, said Joy doubtfully.
Although she'd quite like to ascertain where the fault did lie in each of these breakups.
Does anyone need, began Savannah.
We're fine.
Stan cut her off. There was silence for a moment. Stan kept idiotically clutching his balloon. Joy didn't know if it was fury or nausea rising in her belly. Was she about to vomit or yell? Faint? Or cry. All of them seemed like possibilities.
Troy said, seeing as the curveballs are coming from every direction, I might throw one more.
Fabulous, said Joy through gritted teeth. You do that, Troy. Throw us another curveball. You throw it right at me, darling.
Right. Well, okay then, Mum, said Troy.
He actually looked nervous. It couldn't be another breakup. He wouldn't bother telling them. He was in and out of relationships all the time.
I was considering keeping it a secret, but to hell with it. I could do with your advice.
He moved his glass to one side, sloshing red wine onto the white tablecloth. Was he drunk? Was Joy herself drunk? She really did feel very strange indeed. He said, "So, you remember Claire?"
"Well, for goodness sake, Troy, yes, we remember Claire," said Joy.
Claire was Troy's ex-wife, once a much-loved member of the family, just like Indira, and, to a lesser extent, Grant. It was like a death each time her children broke up with someone, and over the years there had been many, many deaths. She would write that in her memoir. "When I look back over the last decade, it's like looking at a battlefield strewn with the corpses of all the perfectly lovely young men and women who have been in unsuccessful relationships with my annoying, ungrateful children." What would the little innocent teacher think of that? She did say to try to be colourful.
Troy said, "So, I saw Claire when I was in the States."
"Are you getting back together?"
Amy's face was full of foolish hope.
"Of course they're not getting back together," said Joy, to conceal her own foolish hope.
Surely not. Hadn't Claire gone off to Texas or somewhere like that? Somewhere that made you think of cowboys and married an American cardiologist? A friend of a friend from when Troy and Claire lived together in the US?
"No, she's happily married, permanently settled in the US. said Troy. "She's ready to have a baby."
"Well, I'm not surprised. She was ready to have a baby with you all those years ago," said Joy bitterly. Claire and Troy had been in the process of going through IVF when their marriage broke up. Apparently Troy had been unfaithful, and at the time Joy had been so angry with him she hadn't been able to look him in the eye for a good 6 months. She shivered violently. "It was too hot or too cold in here."
"So she and her husband have been trying for a long time now, and apparently they haven't been having any luck," said Troy.
"Oh no," said Brooke. "Tell me she doesn't want to use."
"Yes," said Troy.
He looked at his sister, who seemed to have guessed something that Joy couldn't even imagine.
"Yes, she does." "Use what?"
asked Stan.
"Well, we've kept our embryos on ice all this time, from when we were doing IVF. Claire has been paying the storage costs. Anyway, now she's wondering how I would feel if she tried her luck with one of those."
Joy felt like she was stumbling about in the dark for a light switch.
"You mean Claire wants to have your baby? But I don't understand. Why can't she do IVF with her new husband? Make some new embryos?"
She tripped over the word embryos. When she was getting pregnant, there had just been babies or no babies.
"She had low ovarian reserve back when she was doing IVF with Troy," said Brooke, who remembered everyone's medical histories. "She's probably got no more eggs."
"But you'd be this child's father," said Joy.
And she saw Troy as a baby, the cutest and naughtiest of her babies. He'd wail so loudly each time he woke, you'd think he was dying. And Joy would go running, tricked every time. And the instant she picked him up, the crying would stop. Like a switch had been flicked, and he'd smile that heart-melting smile, crocodile tears still wet on his fat, rosy cheeks. "She wants her husband to formally adopt the child as soon as it's born," said Troy. And Joy heard him trip on the word husband in the same way she'd tripped on embryo.
"But could you be involved if you wanted to be involved?" asked Amy.
Troy shrugged. "She says it's up to me. But what would be the point of me turning up every few months and taking the kid out to McDonald's like some sad divorced dad? Better if it just thinks the cardiologist is its father, don't you think?"
Joy was on a boat being rocked about on a stormy sea. She met Stan's eye. He looked stunned. She could tell he didn't really get it. The brand new possibilities and dilemmas created by modern technology, modern science, and modern thinking were beyond him.
"You like this idea?" asked Logan.
"No, I don't like the idea at all," said Troy. And there it was, a flash of anguish. "To be frank, I hate the idea."
"Well then, mate, you're not obliged.
But it could be Claire's only chance to have her own biological child." Troy lifted his hands in a hopeless gesture of surrender. "Her only chance. Ever. How can I take that away from her? When those embryos are just sitting there. It would be so cruel." His voice dropped, and he moved his wine glass around in circles on the red wine stain on the tablecloth, as if he could rub it away, which he couldn't. That stain would be there forever. Troy added in a small, remorseful voice, "Especially after what I did to her."
"Oh, for goodness sake." This was exactly how Joy used to feel when Troy got in trouble as a kid, and he'd sit there in front of her and Stan, head hanging, hands dangling between his knees, looking so sad, remorseful and bewildered, as if the actions he'd taken hadn't been his choice. Not really, but he was once again stuck with their consequences.
"I think I have to say yes, don't I?" He looked up the table at Joy.
"Don't I, Mum?"
Joy sighed. She put a hand once again to her burning cheek and shuddered. She was freezing.
"Don't you think, Mum?" said Troy. "I have to say yes."
He needed an answer. He'd always looked to her, not his father, for answers to the moral quandaries in which he found himself.
"I stole this CD, Mum, and now I feel bad about it. Should I just take it back to the shop and tell them? But I kind of scratched it."
Oh, Troy. Joy thought of Claire's parents. She and Stan had met them only a handful of times, but they'd liked them. Uncomplicated and kind people. They'd even played doubles against them. The mother, Teresa, had a nice double-handed backhand. Joy had been mortified when her son had broken Teresa's daughter's heart like that. She'd phoned her and told her she was so sorry and she was ashamed of Troy, and Teresa had been kind and gracious. If the situations had been reversed, Joy would have been well-mannered too, but cool and snippy. Now that nice woman would get Joy's grandchild, and Joy wouldn't be allowed to see it, to hold it, or know it. What if the baby had Troy's smile and Claire's beautiful red hair? Joy would have especially loved a red-headed grandchild. "Yes," she said to Troy, "you're right. You have to say yes. It's the right thing to do."
"Well, I don't know," began Stan uneasily.
"It's the right thing to do," Joy hissed at him. He shut up. Yes, this was the right thing to do, but it was also the wrong thing. What if this child, this dear little red-headed child who she already loved but might never meet, turned out to be Joy's only grandchild? She said suddenly, "Maybe you should all go home now." Everyone stared at her. "I'm not feeling the best," she said. "I feel like I'm coming down with something." All of a sudden, she recognized the combination of symptoms she'd been experiencing for the last few days. What a foolish old woman she was. She had a damned UTI, just like the one she had on her honeymoon, because of the recent unusual sexual activity.
Now she was furious with Stan, sitting there like a silent, stupid monolith at the end of the table with his balloon, contributing nothing except a UTI at her age. She picked up her glass and took a long drink of water, although that ship had clearly sailed. She needed antibiotics, and it was Sunday, so she couldn't go to her lovely GP, Susan. She'd have to go to a medical centre, and she'd have to tell a kid straight out of medical school about her sex life. "Damn it to hell," she said to Stan.
"Eh?" said Stan.
"Why are you looking at me? What did I do?"
"Well, for one thing, you killed Dennis Christos," she said.
And it was so strange, because she hadn't even been thinking about poor Dennis, what with everything that was going on, but the accusation had been sitting there these past 6 months, ready and waiting in her subconscious for just the perfect moment.
"Dennis Christos died of a heart attack," Stan responded instantly, without any confusion at all, conclusive proof of his guilt. "You made him think he was going to break your serve, and his poor heart couldn't handle it."
"He could not really have believed he was going to break my serve," scoffed Stan.
"You let the game get to love 40, cried Joy.
"Well, I'm sorry," said Stan, sounding not at all sorry.
"Don't apologize to me. Apologize to poor grieving Debbie Christos."
"Never admit liability, Dad," said Troy. "That's my tip."
"I bet it is," said Logan.
"Dennis Christos once made a very inappropriate remark to me," commented Amy, "if that makes you feel any better, Mum. Very inappropriate."
"Should we give Dad our gifts before we go?" asked Brooke anxiously.
"What have I done wrong?"
The words exploded from Joy without her permission. Everyone looked at her like stunned bloody mullets.
"You haven't done anything wrong, Mum," said Amy soothingly.
"Then how is it that not a single one of you can maintain a long-term relationship? Did your father and I not set a good example to you? Of a good marriage?"
Her children all dropped their heads as if she'd called for volunteers for an unpleasant task.
"So your dad and I weren't perfect," she said. "But, well, we weren't that bad, were we? Are you punishing us for something?" "For what? For making you play tennis?" "We did not make you play tennis. Never. You loved tennis. You were all so talented."
"We're not punishing you," said Troy. "That's crazy talk, Mum."
"It's just bad luck," said Brooke. "Bad timing." She shot Logan a steely look.
"I couldn't believe it when I heard that Logan and Indira had broken up too."
"Mum," said Amy, "you will get to be a grandmother. I mean, obviously I won't have kids, but someone will." She indicated her sister and brothers. "One of them will, in the normal way. Not like what Troy is doing, which is obviously weird and upsetting, but you will get a proper grandchild. I promise you."
"How can you promise me that, Amy? I don't see your brothers and sister rushing to agree with you. And what do you mean? You obviously won't have children."
"Why not? Anyway, why are you talking about grandchildren? Have I mentioned grandchildren? Ever? Not once."
Joy's whole body burned and shook with the injustice of it.
"Never once. Did I? Well, did I?"
If she wasn't to be rewarded for her forbearance, it should at least be recognised.
"You never did, Mum," said Brooke. And she sounded so sad, as if she might cry, and also frightened, as if Joy were drunk or mad or sick.
"Just like you never said how much you wanted us to win," said Troy quietly.
Joy stood. Her legs were wobbly.
The only person whose eyes met hers was her damned husband. She could see what he wanted to do right now. She could see it settle over him, a deadly stillness or silence, like everything was shutting down. It had been 20 years since he'd done it, but she still recognized the signs. She always used to know when it was coming. She'd see it before the children did, and if she acted fast, she could intercept, she could avert the crisis. The feeling had been like running to catch something before it shattered, except you weren't allowed to run. Maybe it was how bomb disposal people felt. But she was no longer in the business of bomb disposal. She was too old for it, and she could not believe she had ever put up with it in the first place. "Don't you dare!" She pointed a shaky finger at him. "Don't you even think about it!" She swayed on her feet. The ache of grief and humiliation spread not just across her stomach, but all the way up her left side. It was Savannah who got to her first and supported her with a surprisingly strong grip. "Make them all go," Joy said to her. "Make them all go home." Chapter 25. Now. It was now 15 days since Joy Delaney had been seen by her family. "My mother got very sick on Father's Day," said Brooke Delaney. "She collapsed. It turned out she had a kidney infection. We had to call an ambulance."
"That must have given you all a fright," said Christina.
Christina and Ethan were interviewing Joy Delaney's youngest daughter at her physiotherapy practice, surrounded by exercise equipment. There were only two chairs. Ethan had accepted Brooke's offer to sit on the balance ball, which he did with great aplomb, diligently taking notes. Christina would have fallen off. They had met Brooke at the press conference, but it had taken a few days for this interview to be scheduled. Christina couldn't be sure if Brooke had been deliberately delaying. Right now, she seemed keen to be cooperative, or at least to give that impression. "Well, yes, it did give us a fright," said Brooke. "We didn't know what was going on at first. Mum was behaving so oddly. We thought it was because she was upset, not sick."
"What was she upset about?"
"I felt especially bad," reflected Brooke, "because I'm the one with medical training. She had a fever. I should have realized."
"She was upset about something?"
pushed Christina. "Just family stuff," said Brooke. "My brother and I have both broken up with our partners. Ah, and Dad decided it would be a good day to do a comprehensive analysis of our failed tennis careers." She gave a faint smile.
"So what was your impression of Savannah?" asked Christina.
She burned her tongue, sipping the too hot cup of tea that Brooke had made for her. "She was just a sweet, quiet girl. She'd cooked all this food for us, but then she was kind of serving us in our parents' house. It was odd and uncomfortable. It was like she was Cinderella, barely eating anything herself, and both my parents had become strangely enamored of her, dependent on her. It was like she'd turned up and solved a problem we didn't realize needed solving."
"What problem was that?"
Brooke considered the question. "I guess maybe the problem of cooking or the problem of retirement. My parents aren't the sort of people who dreamed of retirement. They loved to work."
"Has your mother shown signs of depression recently?"
"Absolutely not," said Brooke. She blinked. "Things haven't been great recently, but Mum is not the sort of person to get depressed."
"What about your father then? Is he the sort of person to get depressed?"
He can get grumpy, said Brooke carefully, but never violent, if that's what you're implying.
I don't want to imply anything, said Christina. I'm just gathering information about your parents' states of mind.
I wish you could see my father coaching a child, said Brooke. Even a child with no talent, especially a child with no talent. He was so gentle and patient, so passionate about tennis. He just always wanted everyone to love tennis as much as he did.
This told Christina nothing. Gentle people snapped. People who were patient and kind in some circumstances were cruel and vicious in others.
But he's not coaching anymore, right? Your parents are retired and you said they loved to work. So I take it they haven't been enjoying retirement.
They've been floundering a bit, said Brooke. They tried travelling, but they didn't know how to holiday. We didn't really do holidays in our family.
You never went on a holiday?
Well, we did. Every summer we went for a week to a caravan park on the central coast, admitted Brooke, which was kind of fun. She frowned. Kind of not. She sighed. But there was never time for many holidays because we all played competitive tennis. We were either travelling to a tournament or training for one, and my parents were trying to run a coaching school at the same time.
Was it a happy childhood?
Asked Christina. She hadn't got a handle yet on this family. On the surface, they seemed loving and cheerful, but she could sense dysfunction bubbling ominously beneath their sporty, matter-of-fact demeanours.
I don't know, said Brooke.
She picked up a ballpoint pen, chewed on it, and then seemed to catch herself, removed it from her mouth and put it back on the desk in front of her and pushed it away.
I mean, yes, it was happy. It was very busy. It was dominated by tennis. Tennis hijacks your childhood. There's no time for anything else.
Did you resent having your childhood hijacked?
Not at all. I loved tennis. We all loved tennis.
You still play? Christina looked at the framed print of a tennis player on the wall. Brooke's nostrils flared.
Not competitively. I play with my dad every now and then, for fun.
So, growing up, did your parents put a lot of pressure on you to win?
We put pressure on ourselves, said Brooke. We all wanted to win.
She followed Christina's eyes to the picture of the tennis player who was stretching for a backhand as if a life depended on it.
It's hard to want something so badly and give it your all and then not get it. There's this idea that all you need to do is believe in yourself. But the truth is, we all can't be Martina.
Martina? Christina checked her notes. Was that the older sister?
Navratilova, said Ethan. He pointed at the poster.
Oh, of course, said Christina. The only tennis player she knew was the angry one from the 80s, McEnroe. She had an uncle who used to put on an American accent to imitate his tantrums.
You cannot be serious!
Ethan said to Brooke, when you said things haven't been great recently, is that because there was some fallout following that Father's Day lunch?
Astute question.
Christina watched Brooke's body language as she answered. Her shoulders went up and she stretched her neck in a turtle-like manner to make them drop.
There was no fallout, she said definitively. There were just a few things said out loud that day that had never been said out loud before, that's all. Then Mum was sick in hospital and we all focused on that.
Was that the truth? Or was that when things began to fray?
Okay, then, so why do you think things haven't been so great lately? Asked Christina.
Brooke went very still. I don't know, she said, and she didn't blink. There was the lie, right there. Christina could point at it like a doctor points out a fracture on an X-ray. She did so know. Christina waited. Are you sure? She said gently. Are you sure you don't know? Two spots of colour rose on Brooke's cheeks. Yes, I'm sure. So back to your parents' house guest, said Christina. She was alone with your father? While your mother was in hospital? Yes, said Brooke. It was only two nights. Right, said Christina. That was long enough. She waited. Brooke didn't flinch. Then your mother came home from hospital and Savannah stayed on? Yes, said Brooke. We were grateful because she was doing all the cooking. I believe it's around this time that your brother Logan discovered something unwelcome about Savannah. This time, Brooke definitely did flinch. Had she not expected this information to be passed on? If not, why not? Brooke recovered fast, although she had to work too hard to maintain eye contact. Did Logan tell you that? He did, said Christina. Logan had mentioned it in a sudden rush just before he had to hurry off to teach a class. Can you tell me more? Well, said Brooke, and she spoke gingerly, as if she were tiptoeing her way through broken glass. Logan was just sitting at home one day when he discovered something about Savannah that made us all feel a bit... She broke eye contact to try to find the right word. Ethan wobbled on his balance ball. Nervous, finished Brooke. Chapter 26. Last October. It was the middle of the day, the middle of the week, the middle of his life. Logan had taught an early morning class and now he was back home, on his green leather couch, in his half-empty townhouse, on a clear, sunlit day filled with birdsong, lawnmowers and leaf blowers, and the sound of his next-door neighbour learning the cello. She'd left a preemptive note, "Thank you for your patience while I learn the cello." Logan channel surfed, drank warm beer and ate cold leftover pizza for his lunch and tried to stop his eyes continually leaving the television and returning to all the blank spaces in the apartment left by Indira. There was a blank space in front of him where Indira should have been standing right now, hands on her hips. Do you realise the sun is shining out there? She thought it was illegal to watch television when the sun was shining. It was because she and her family had emigrated from the UK when she was 12, and she still appreciated Australian sunshine in a way that Logan, who grew up with the sun in his eyes, never could. He saw sunlight as a peril, an obstacle to overcome on the court, like the wind. She saw it as a daily miracle. She'd left behind literal blank spots too, like the faded rectangle on the wall where she'd hung that god-awful abstract painting she'd bought from an artist at the markets in Hobart, and the flattened carpet by the front door where her pointless vintage hat rack used to stand. Except apparently it hadn't been pointless, because Logan kept going to chuck things on it, like his hoodie, and it kept right on not being there, its absence so surprisingly consistent, like the balls of dirty grey fluff that still floated disconsolately around the space in the laundry where Indira's bamboo laundry hamper once stood. She'd left behind her washing machine. It glared at him each time he attempted to use it. It was a small, fiddly front loader with too many cycle options. Indira had done all their laundry. She loved laundry. She'd sometimes peeled socks off his feet just to wash them. At least the fridge still liked him. He'd had it for years. It stayed, solemn and stolid, humming softly to itself through each relationship breakup as the tubs of Greek yogurt and punnets of strawberries vanished, to be replaced once again by pizza boxes and multiple six-packs of beer. Faithful old fridge. For Christ's sake, he was turning into his mother, personifying his appliances. He stared at the blank rectangle on the wall as if it were a bricked-up window and he was uselessly looking for a view that was long gone, for an explanation that was not forthcoming. "It's beautiful," she used to say about the god-awful painting. "It makes me feel alive." "It's god-awful," he would say, and he'd heard the echo of his parents in their banter. Or he thought that's what he heard. Maybe Indira heard something else. Her parents had an unhappy marriage. She might have heard the echoes of something entirely different. He thought he was being funny and flirty, but maybe she thought he was being nasty. Maybe she hated doing the laundry. Maybe they'd been living side by side in entirely different realities. It was an awful painting, but he missed it, just like he missed her questions, her perfume, her insistence he eat bananas for the potassium. She was obsessed with potassium. Her runners by the front door, her high-pitched sneezes, the unfathomable pleasure she took in capturing the Pokemon that apparently loitered invisibly throughout their apartment. Were they still here, waiting, hopefully, for her to capture them on her phone? Her butterfly kisses on the back of his neck early on a Sunday morning. Her... Jesus. Enough. He picked up his phone and called his friend Hien, because Logan was not fucking passive. He was keeping a daily inventory of his non-passive actions. He was the only one in his circle of old school friends who ever picked up the phone, and all his friends' wives noticed this and told their husbands, "You're all so lucky you've got Logan." "You thought about it yet?" asked Hien as soon as he answered. "Eh?" Logan hadn't thought about anything. "Thought about what?" But then he remembered that Hien believed his 6-year-old son was the next Nadal, and he wanted Logan to coach him. And he didn't care that Logan hadn't coached since he was a teenager helping out at Delaney's. Logan had preferred coaching to all the other jobs they had to do, but he didn't need to do it now. "I told you already, I don't coach," said Logan. "I gave you a list of names." "Just see him play," said Hien, "just once. I used to come to all your matches."
"You did not?"
"I came to one," said Hien. "You were good."
"No shit, Sherlock," said Logan. "I ranked, yeah, whatever, mate. I don't care what you ranked. Your time is done. But my kid is the future, and he could be your future. You'll see. You and Indira come for lunch and then we'll head down to the local courts and see what you think."
"Hien," said Logan, "I want you to coach him. No one else, not even your dad. I'm doing you a favour. You think about it. Gotta go." Logan tossed the phone aside on the couch and laughed a little. Even hard-nosed Hien had turned into a typical tennis parent, blinded by love for his kid. Hien's wife and Indira were good friends, but Indira must not have told her yet about the breakup. His friends would react in the same way as his family had on Father's Day. People liked Indira more than him. He'd always known this, and this was the first time he'd cared. He felt unfairly maligned. Even bloody Troy had looked at him like he was a fool for letting her go. He remembered his mother's words just before her dramatic collapse. "Did your father and I not set a good example to you of a good marriage?"
He'd never considered his parents' marriage something that could be rated. In his mind, it didn't exist relative to anything else. It just was. He guessed that he had an unconscious, childish belief that his parents were not really two individuals, but one unit. They had been together for half a century, after all, and they worked together, played tennis together. He rarely saw them apart. Had they set a good example of a good marriage? For the first time, he truly considered the question. He liked the way his parents teased each other. It was like watching them play a game. And when he and his siblings were little, they hadn't understood the rules, but they'd known it was a fun game. He obviously preferred to know nothing about their sex life, but he liked that they'd always touched and hugged and kissed, more than other people's parents. His father was so large and his mother so small, he could lift her up under her armpits and put her down somewhere else when he chose. And even as a child, Logan could tell his mother liked it when he did that, even when she pretended to resist, which was part of the game. Logan would never attempt to do that to Indira. She was violently ticklish. She would probably have headbutted him if he ever tried to pick her up. She also believed herself to be too heavy for him to lift. She had issues with her body. He loved her body, but he had to be meticulously careful about what he said. Indira preferred to pretend she didn't have a body at all. In the beginning, he used to compliment her, and she'd turn on him. "You're lying. You're just saying that. How could you say that? I know you don't mean that. My legs are revolting. My arms are disgusting." Suddenly, he would find himself in the position of defending her body against a cruel attacker, and he didn't know how long or how vigorously he was meant to fight back when she was the attacker. So eventually he surrendered. He stopped saying anything at all. Every relationship has its quixotic rules. You just had to follow them. Only his hands could talk, and he tried to let his hands say everything he wasn't allowed to say out loud. Theirs was a relationship with a lot of touching, not just in the bedroom. They held hands in the street. They lay side by side on this couch when they watched TV. He'd thought all that touching meant that everything that needed to be said was being said. If he'd thought about it, and now he was thinking about it, he might have realized that growing up, he hadn't liked certain aspects of his parents' marriage. He'd hated it when his mother made faces behind his father's back and muttered bitter remarks, so low that only her children could hear. "Well, I told him that was going to happen, and did he listen?" No, he did not listen. He hadn't liked it when his father used to get the final word in an argument, not by yelling, but by leaving. "I hated it when my father left." He felt a rush of memory, as if he'd smelled a long-forgotten scent from his childhood. There was a dropping-away sensation in his stomach, like tripping in a dream. He hadn't thought about that in years. Maybe he'd never really thought about it. At some point, his father had stopped doing it, and the memory had vanished, the way old clothes vanished, and you forgot they had ever existed until an old photo reminded you. "I loved that T-shirt." One day, his father came back and never did it again, and years and years piled on top of those particular memories, obliterating them from view. His mother no longer pulled faces or made bitter asides, and his father no longer left. His phone rang, and he jumped. He picked it up, saw it was Indira. He studied her name, considered putting his thumb on decline. Indira was determined to stay friends. She had this new way of talking to him now, without a trace of emotion. She sounded like a friendly customer service representative.
She was a nearly perfect clone of his Indira, except that something essential and beautiful was missing. He muted the television, answered.
"Hi, Logan," she said in her friendly telemarketer voice. "How are you?"
"I'm well, Indira. How are you?" He didn't quite imitate her tone, but close. She paused and in a slightly less friendly but more normal tone said,
"I thought I'd just call to check if your mum has been discharged from hospital."
She could have texted, "How's your mum?" That's what he would have done. Or she could have just disappeared from his life like other ex-girlfriends. But she was staying in touch, remaining dutifully apprised of family news. He wanted to tell her this wasn't necessary. If he wasn't getting her warm body next to him in bed, he didn't want her cold, friendly voice in his ear. "She's back home," he said. "They only kept her 2 nights."
"Oh, good. That's good. And is that girl still staying with them?"
"Yeah," said Logan. "She is. She cooks for them. Mum loves it. It's strange. It's nice. It's comforting. It's kind of frightening." He didn't know what to say or feel about Savannah. She seemed to make both his parents happy. How could he complain about that? He looked at the blank spot above the television. "How are you?" Indira was in Perth, where her parents had relocated a year ago. She did not get on with her parents, yet she was prepared to stay with them on the other side of the country. That's how badly she no longer wanted to be in a relationship with Logan.
"This morning, my parents yelled at each other for 10 minutes about a water glass," she said, and she forgot to use her clone voice. "They don't even seem to be aware they're yelling. That's just their default position."